Hey, I'm Danny Washington, and welcome to 21st Century Mermaids. As a dedicated ocean advocate, STEM educator, and avid underwater adventurer, I consider myself a modern-day mermaid. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, determination, and a bit of style. Guests we feature are actively welcome the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development and addressing the UN's 2019 theme for World Oceans Day, which is Gender and the Ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid. Intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our big blue planet. Runke, we're so happy that you're here with us on 21st Century Mermaids. It's exciting to have our first mermaid from Nigeria joining this season. And, you know, I haven't been to Nigeria yet personally, but I went to Ghana for the first time in 2019, neighboring country. But I had the most magical experience. And in fact, today I'm wearing the necklace that I got there, and I absolutely adore it. And it meant so much to go back to Africa, to the continent where, you know, my heritage is. And of course, obviously that's where you're from, but I'm curious, you know, what does it mean to you to be a marine scientist in your community at this moment? Tell me like the big picture of what that means to you.
Well, being a marine scientist to me is, you know, my way of life, more or less, has become a way of life. Because my career is actually in marine science. I work as a researcher at the Institute of Oceanography. And one way or the other, I also find myself very passionate about the ocean and the sustainable usage. So as a result of that, I find myself doing a lot of things around the ocean, you know, such as cleaning up the beaches, rescuing sea turtles, and so many other things. Because when I started out as a researcher, I didn't just want to research all the time, be in the lab all the time. I wanted action, you know, around ocean conservation. So one way or the other, it has become a way of life to me because every day, you know, I get involved. Even when I don't want to get involved, I get involved in, you know, ocean issues, conservation issues, and all sorts.
I love that you said it's a way of life because I completely agree. It is a lifestyle to work in the space of marine science and ocean conservation because it's a job that never ends. There's always something happening, you know, in the ocean that's different, that's new. And as we've seen in the last few decades, human impacts on the ocean have become more prevalent. And now for people in this community, it's absolutely essential that we're involved every day and we incorporate it into our lifestyle. So when did you originally become interested in the ocean? Was it something that you've always been interested in or did it come about later in life?
Well, I'll say it's not something I've always been interested in, but it's something that crept into my life, you know, when I was a teenager. Because originally I wanted to be a medical doctor because that's always the aim for all parents in Africa. You want your child to be a medical doctor. My dad used to buy me a lot of novels. So when I became a teenager, I started buying novels and I read a lot of ocean-related fiction. You know, precisely there was a story of a guy called Deck Tet. He had so many ocean adventures, getting into a submersible, doing all kinds of things, you know, and then all those fiction characters, Admiral Sandeka and so many things like that. So it was kind of in me, you know, reading so many things about the ocean. When I was seeking admission in the university, I couldn't get into the medical sciences that I wanted originally. So like there were very few options, you know, do zoology, do microbiology and all that. So I chose to go for zoology. It was while I started zoology my first year that I became interested in marine biology, because marine biology was just created out of the zoology department, you know, at that time.
So you wanted to try something new?
Yes. You know, when I did zoology for the first year, you know, it was so abstract and kind of boring. So I tried to change to marine biology, you know, in the second year, but the department did not allow me. They did not release me, you know, because they didn't want all the students to leave the zoology department. So I finished with zoology, but my project was something on fish. You know, I worked on tilapia fish and the impact of petroleum dispersant on tilapia fish. So that's where it all started from. And as a result of that, I got to know more about, you know, aquatic ecotoxicology. So when I finished from zoology, I lectured, you know, I lectured for like a year. And then I decided to go back for my master's. And this time around, I said I was going to go for marine biology because I already had, you know, I had the drive, you know, for marine biology, and it was somehow it was in me. So that's how I got into to study marine biology for my master's.
That's awesome. I'm curious, what did your dad think when you told him that you were switching to marine biology?
He was very excited, you know, because then, you know, a lot of people didn't know there were so many other arms of sciences, you know. What everybody thinks in Nigeria is doctor, you know, that's popular. But they didn't really know much about other areas of sciences. And of course, marine biology was very new at the time when I was starting my bachelor degree in 1995. There was no marine biology department in my school. So the marine biology department was set up in 1996. So prior to that time, there was nothing like marine biology.
That's incredible. And did you have any particular mentors during that time when you were doing your master's and your bachelor's that were kind of helping you along the way?
Exactly, yes. When I was doing my master's, I had my supervisor, Dr. Clement Edopai, you know, was my mentor because I wanted to do aquaculture. I wanted to, you know, maybe set up a fish farm and make some, you know, money. But he wanted me to do the core, you know, the core science. So what I did was I did sampling of macrobentic invertebrate fauna of an estuarine drainage canal very close to the school. So he made me, you know, go through everything. I had to collect plantains, collect benthos, and then collect the larvivorous fish. So somehow I kept on delving further into marine biology. So he was a very nice lecturer, and so we all felt at home with him. And I also had my my seminar supervisor, Professor Chukwu, who also supervised me on muddy shores. I had to write a term paper on muddy shores. So I learned a lot of things, you know.
It sounds to me as though, you know, you're definitely a trailblazer, especially since there was no marine biology department at your university at the time. You found your mentors and you made it happen. So what has been the greatest triumph for you thus far in your career?
Well, I think one of the greatest trial is that when I finished my master's, I attended a conference in the UK at the National Maritime Museum. My closest friend then, you know, was a lady called Melissa. So she was telling me a lot. They asked me, do you have sea turtles in Nigeria? I, as a master's student, didn't know we had sea turtles in Nigeria. Whereas when I got back, that is the project I've been doing, you know, to unravel the mysteries behind sea turtles in Nigeria. And I was able to find out that we have them, and we don't only have them, they nest all along our coast, which was information that nobody really, you know, had the time.
That's incredible. I mean, wow. And they're such dynamic animals, right? Like, I feel like sea turtles are definitely charismatic animals that a lot of people gravitate toward and think about. And the fact that you were able to find out and confirm that sea turtles were nesting on Nigerian coastlines, that's massive. So tell me a little bit more about that particular research project and the research you're doing now on sea turtles. What other information have you found out?
So basically, when I got back to Nigeria, you know, I got married, and after that, I rested for a while. I didn't work for a while until 2008, when I joined the Institute of Oceanography on the Highland, which is just in front of the Barbage. And that was when action started, because I was asked, what would you like to do? I said, I would like to do marine conservation, because actually I wanted to have an NGO before that employment opportunity came up. So I didn't give up on my ideas, because my idea was to set up a marine conservation society in Nigeria. So I didn't give up. So instead, I, you know, transferred the ideas I have to the work I was doing. So I told my mentor, Dr. Sholari, then I said, sir, I want to research on sea turtles. And luckily, he had attended a conference on sea turtle in Malta. And he was like, okay. So he asked me to follow him out on a field trip. And when we went out for that field trip, we found out, you know, how sea turtles were being entangled in gill nets, because it was a project. So immediately after that, my drive was so, I was so excited. I went back to the community with my own, we started asking them about sea turtles. You see sea turtles? Then we found an Olive Ridley shell. So
wow.
From there, we were able to know that people actually, sea turtles actually nest on our beaches. But because they are nesting on the beaches and the coastal communities are living there, and very few people go into their private fortress to know what is happening. But from that time, I didn't let the community go. I always follow up to find out, did you see any turtles? What did you do with it? So that was how we started what I call the Sea Turtle Rescue and Release, you know, project, which really isn't funded by anyone. But anytime we find a sea turtle anywhere, we just try to rescue it, you know. We call anybody we can call, please help us. We need to rescue this sea turtle. Unfortunately, sea turtle rescue in Nigeria is not free. You have to pay a ransom, because the coastal community, they're very poor and they always insist on getting a ransom. Since 2008, you know, until recently, we had to pay out of pocket. But recently, there is, you know, a kind of awareness, more awareness about conservation. And now the government is coming up to bring in deterrents for these people to stop capturing the turtles and eating them, you know, because there is not really much enforcement of wildlife laws in Nigeria. But recently this year, there's been like more awareness, more gravitation towards, you know, illegal wildlife captures. So now we are at a point, where people, when they capture sea turtle now, they can be arrested or intercepted by the relevant agencies. And this came about because I created the Nigerian Sea Turtle Network, you know, where we have so many people coming together, and that has really helped, because you have scientists on the network, you have enforcement people on the network, you have sea turtle enthusiasts on the network, and so many people have joined the network recently, and it's really helping out, because everyone is spreading the word, don't capture our sea turtles. So that's one side of the work I do. The other side of it is the research I've been doing on the nesting sea turtle. And this is my PhD work, and it involves doing nesting surveys, and then deploying temperature loggers in the beaches to see how the temperatures of the beaches changes and how it's influenced by plastic pollution relative to sea turtles. So that's another aspect of what I do. And also, I'm very involved with plastic debris, you know, eradication. And this I also came about as a result of the sea turtle research I do. You know, while I was doing some nesting survey in 2014, there were a lot of plastics on the beaches. Then my professor, a visiting professor at that time, Professor Magirodont, he kind of said, Ronki, why don't you look at how these plastics, you know, are influencing the temperature of the sand, you know, whether there's going to be a change. Because if there is a change, it will ultimately affect the hatchling sexes, because we know that hatchling sexes in sea turtle is temperature dependent, and with climate change, it will affect their population. So So basically, I've done so many things around sea turtles because I'm like more or less the first person, you know, doing any form of research on sea turtles. And it hasn't been too easy, but I've kept forging ahead. One adventure leads to another, and I find myself delving further into turtle, you know. Even during COVID, I felt I would relax. I find myself being more involved in the Nigerian Sea Turtle Network that I set up, which is a WhatsApp group, which there wasn't really too much activity. But of recent, so many people have joined the group. People from the Nigerian Conservation Foundation have joined. People from the British High Commission have joined, and everybody is interested in what's happening to the sea turtles, you know. Let them stop capturing, let them stop collecting ransom. So we are now, you know, really on anybody that brings sea turtles, you know, stop this, stop selling sea turtles. So that's where we are presently.
That's so impressive. And I think that what I heard most out of what you just mentioned through that story is the importance of community and how you work with local communities, but you have different stakeholders that you have to interact with, right? You said the government, you have the fishers, you have enforcement agencies, and then of course your network. And so how do you create, I guess, a balanced communication dynamic between all of those different groups through your work? I'm just curious, like different tactics, like how do you make sure that all these different groups are communicating? I know it's a challenge, but I'm sure many people listening would love to know, because it's something that I've seen plenty of clotheslines, especially when it comes to sea turtles, having to deal with how to create these groups and making sure that they're all on the same page.
Okay, so what I do is like, I do a lot of engagements, you know. I think I'm good at engaging and mobilizing as one of my strengths. So I use it to my advantage for sea turtles, you know. Like when I went, there was a training I went for in the Netherlands, they taught us a stakeholder analysis, knowing who your stakeholders are. So what I do is I work with each group from the angle where they can understand the need for sea turtles to be conserved. For example, with the coastal communities, when we go to them, we'll let them know that we understand your vulnerabilities. We understand the challenges. We understand that, you know, not too much is being done for you by government. But then I bring in the selling point to them that if you conserve your sea turtles, they can bring in more funds for you. Because rather than eating one sea turtle, poaching it and eating it and it's gone, if you preserve your sea turtles instead, you can begin to have a little sanctuary and people will come and be watching.
Ecotourism.
Yes, even though they hardly listen, they want the immediate cash, but I keep talking to them. And over the years, I've developed, you know, a number of relationships with them. And I also make sure that anything we're doing in research, we try to, most of the research I do is always targeted toward the coastal communities. Like I did marine plastic debris campaign in the coastal communities where we train the people on how to upcycle, you know, bottles into reusable items. So they like it. So when you go out to them with things like that, they will become more friendly and they'll be willing to listen to what you have to say. So that's how I engage the coastal communities. Then the researchers, of course, are my colleagues. How I engage them is, anytime a sea turtle is found, I get to the office and I say, oh, we have a sea turtle rescue. Let's go, let's go, let's go. We get a vehicle. We rush there. We begin to talk to people. We begin to haggle and negotiate. Oh, the people don't want to release the turtle. Oh, this is how much I want to collect. Then we try and negotiate to the barest minimum. Then we say, okay, first of all, we do sensitization. We show them pictures of sea turtles, you know. We tell them, this is how they're conserving in Ghana, in other countries. Then the mind of the fisherman would have been enlightened before we now say, after we have talked to you, are you willing to release the sea turtle? Then some of them will now say, yes, they are willing. But unfortunately, they are very poor. They have spent a lot of money on fueling the boats and all that. Can we please help them? So we now give them maybe a little stipend. Then we go together with them to release the sea turtle, you know. And when we release the sea turtle, we try and make it, we make it fun. We can say, oh, go turtle, go turtle, go. you know, I will cover with a video. So it has become kind of popular. And there was a particular beach cleanup we did in 2016 that was covered by a television station, and that went all over Lagos. So a lot of NGOs started copying what we did. And you know, as a result of that, they are like, several people that are visiting up to the sea turtle course too. And they also rescue and release. But everybody, you know, so that's how I engage, you know, the researchers. Then for the NGOs, the way I engage them is when they got interested in the sea turtle thing in 2016 and they approached me that they wanted me to come out and help, I went out there, you know, to support them. That was when I started my Instagram page. You know, they told me, start an Instagram page, show your rescues and all that. So we started an Instagram, because a lot of NGOs are on Instagram. So,
of course,
you know, we started making a lot of noise about, and the youth really bought into it. A lot of people started getting interested and expressing their opinions about sea turtles on Instagram. So that made the people that wanted sea turtles to be protected to increase greatly. And a lot of that, those NGOs are still involved there. So what I did after a while, when I saw the interest was high, was to form a WhatsApp group called the Nigerian Sea Turtle Network. So on that network, conversation goes on at any day a sea turtle is found. Everybody is talking, wow, what should we do? Where are they? And somehow everybody got tired of paying money out of pocket, you know, because the situation is not too friendly in the country now. So of recent, everybody just got angry and tired. So it was on the group we started expressing that frustration that we can't have this. And luckily, someone from the Nigerian Conservation Foundation joined. So he said, we can invite the enforcement because they are agencies that are meant to enforce wildlife. But some of these agencies, they don't even know what a sea turtle is. You know, there are so many disconnects, you know, because like the person that is meant to enforce on the wildlife trade, for example, but cannot identify the species, there's a problem. So, you know, we had to start calling out each agency. So he brought in so many people from different agencies that can enforce. So when they joined, you know, we started calling out anytime a sea turtle is found. Instead of us going there and paying, we'll say, oh, please, can you, you know, we'll call the person from that agency. We'll just, you know, on WhatsApp, we might say, if the person's name is Funky, @Funky, please, this is why you are on this group, you know.
And, and so you just call them out.
So a lot of them will now call back that, Runky, what can we do? I'll tell them, this is what we can do. This is so, and it has really been working of recent, just recently, it has been working out. Because with one of the agency, we had to go to a major hotel where the sea turtle is always sold, where they bring it to get high prices. You know, they know that when white people see these turtles being displayed, because they have more sympathy towards animals, they will definitely pay some dollars and go and release it back to sea. And they've been doing that. The community fishermen, they've been taking advantage of that for a long time. You know, some of them, when you say, oh, release it, they say, oh, why do we pay $100 for sea turtles? They will be so, you know, confident. So recently, we went to one of the major hotels and they sensitized them. And they promised that they won't allow that in front of their hotel anymore. And they even told us that there are even so many other places that even their guests always help to rescue, you know, to release. They don't eat it, but there are so many places where they are selling. So now there is an ongoing sensitization by some of the key agencies that have the responsibility for enforcement. Because my own office, we only have responsibility for research, you know, research and education. We are not mandated to enforce. So now
you're not an enforcement agency.
We're beginning to collaborate with the enforcement agency, both on the network and also on the official basis. So somehow it has worked alongside. You know, setting up the network has really been it has had a great impact on the sea turtle conservation project.
When you say sensitization, are you talking about basically cultivating empathy for the ocean by showing people pictures and imagery and helping them understand the role of sea turtles in the ocean?
When I say sensitization, I mean educating people, exactly, informing them either through speech or usage of IEC materials or sharing videos on WhatsApp, on Facebook, on Instagram, just to get the words out that the sea turtles are in trouble and they need to be conserved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how else can we cultivate more ocean empathy? What would that look like if you tomorrow, if you could do any activity, anything that you would want to bring to your community in order to share more information about the ocean, about sea turtles and protection and plastic pollution, what would you do?
What I've been doing over the years, since 2016, I've been coordinating the International Coastal Cleanup in Lagos. Why we do this is to bring attention to the ocean. And the very first one we had, as fate will have it, we found a sea turtle that morning. You know, we rescued a sea turtle that morning.
The morning of the cleanup.
Yeah, on the cleanup morning. One of my team members found a sea turtle, so we had to rescue it. And then we took it with us to the for the cleanup. Immediately after the cleanup, everybody came and lined up in, you know, two rows. And then the sea turtle was in between. And then we cheered the sea turtle back to sea, saying, go turtle, go. And it was very
go
beautiful.
Turtle, go turtle,
yeah,
go.
Exactly. So that has become the song, you know, and the sea turtle was very happy and was released on that day. So I think one of the best ways of cultivating empathy for the ocean is having ocean activities like cleanups. When people come to cleanups, they'll say, why should I clean up? But by the time they come for the cleanup, and they see the ocean that is meant to be a place of recreation, being a dumping ground, you see, they see it firsthand. It will really help to create more empathy for the ocean, because what you cannot see, you cannot identify with it. For example, at the time when I never knew there were sea turtles in Nigeria, there is nothing I could have done about it. But when you know, when people are aware, when we share videos, people slaughtering leatherbacks, even people that are not scientists, they feel very angry. Oh, is this going on in our country? Why are people so greedy, you know? Or you show pictures of people butchering a whale, you know, a dolphin. Even the youngest children feel annoyed that this should not be happening. So I think one of the best ways of creating empathy for the ocean is doing ocean-related activities like cleanups, like campaigns by the coastside, training young people, you know, to know more about the ocean, about the environment, and also, you know, really being friendly with the ocean. Because like now in Nigeria, when we were younger, we used to go to the beach almost every weekend when we were young. Then the country was very good. But now because of hardship, some teenagers, they've never been to the beach before. So when you say there is a cleanup, oh, all the teenagers, they want to come. Please, are you going to provide a free bus? I'd like to come, you know, because they cannot even afford to come on their own, but they really want that experience. So that's where we are. So to be able to create empathy for the ocean, we have to do ocean activities. We have to take our youth to the ocean side, you know, to learn more about the ocean, to relate with the ocean, to swim and do other things that would make them to understand the needs of the ocean.
Yes. And I referring back to the trip that I took to Ghana in 2019, I think one of the best memories of my life was going onto the beach in Ghana, just in Accra, and seeing thousands, tens of thousands of people on the beach at sunset on New Year's Day. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen, particularly for me, because I'm a Black woman in America, and that's an image that I had never seen before.
Wow.
It was life-changing, to be honest. And we deal with a lot of similar issues where there's lack of access for people of color to coastlines and ocean activities. And what I've found is that many people who live here in the States, and I'm not sure if this is the same in Nigeria, lack this basic skill of swimming, which is the first barrier to getting into the ocean. You have to know how to swim in order to feel comfortable going in, right? So
yeah.
Have you done any work in that regard as far as making sure that particularly youth are getting swimming skills and swimming lessons? Or are there any other organizations that you know of that are doing that kind of work?
I do not really know of any organization that is doing that for you specifically. But I know that a lot of schools have swimming classes, but these are optional. You know, you have to pay for it specially because, you know, for obvious reasons, because they have to pay the swimming instructor and all that. So a lot of children don't really have access. They want to swim, but sometimes their parents are not ready to pay for these extra classes. So, but we have a place in Nigeria called the swimming school. That also, you know, teenagers have to pay to go there to learn. So I will not say there's so much access, you know, to youth and the children in terms of swimming in Nigeria. I think there should be much more access to swimming activities by provision of public spaces. You know, we don't really have parks that are free. You know, most of our parks, hotels, anywhere you can swim, you have to pay for it. So it's not available to everybody. It's not even available to the average citizen, you know, which is such a shame. Because for me, even at my level, I didn't learn swimming till I was like, I was married already before I learned swimming.
Wow. So were you in your 20s when you learned?
No. I was in my 30s when I joined the Institute of Oceanography, precisely. That's when I learned, you know.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. But that proves that it's never too late. It's never too late to learn.
It's never too late, but I won't say I'm an excellent, I won't even say I'm a fierce swimmer yet, because those things are not easy, you know, when you're not used to.
It takes practice.
Yes.
Right. Yes. Absolutely.
It's practice. So I think it's something that every child needs to learn, you know, early in life. If only we can have public places where people can learn swimming for free, I'm sure half the children in Nigeria, if not three quarter, would want to learn immediately.
Absolutely. Yes. I've never met any child, you know, who just doesn't want to learn how to swim. I think that, yeah, it's a natural, it's like an innate thing. And it's also, I believe it to be a human right. I think it's a basic skill set that everyone should have. And that'll change our dynamic with the planet in itself, because 3/4 of the planet is covered in water. So
exactly. The only places you see those skills are in the coastal communities. The children there swim. Obviously, they live by the sea. They swim very, very well. So that's one beautiful thing.
Well, speaking of the entire planet, this podcast, 21st Century Mermaids, is all about focusing on the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development. And we're definitely supporting the goal of protecting at least 30% of the ocean by 2030. Can you tell us about how you've contributed to this achievement of this massive goal, specifically about marine protected areas in Nigeria? Have you been working on that at all?
Well, so far in Nigeria, we don't have a single marine protected area. What I've concentrated largely on is the marine species, even getting them to be recognized and the need for them to be, you know, specifically the sea turtle, you know, the need for them to be conserved in the first place, because people don't even know what species needs to be conserved or which species does not need to be conserved. So that itself has been a lot of effort to bring the sea turtle to a point where people now know that, okay, sea turtles are endangered species and they shouldn't be captured and they are protected by major international laws and convention. Whereas for the marine protected area, I've also been like campaigning, you know, among my colleagues, because a lot of my colleagues, we all feel we should have a marine protected area in Nigeria. And, you know, a lot of people on the Nigerian Sea Turtle Network believe this should happen. But before this can happen, we have to, you know, create awareness, you know, lead campaigns and get the government to gravitate towards this. But this has not happened so far, even though there is
not yet
the urge.
Not yet.
So I think that might be the next step. But as far as I know, what I try to do is to make sure that there's awareness on the need for the ocean to be kept clean and pristine, which is why I do the beach cleanup work along with my team of volunteers to ensure that we clean the beach on a yearly basis and also on a quarterly basis in some locations. So we do a lot of beach cleanups. I do beach cleanups with adults I do it with children. I do it with community. So I've been able to do beach cleanup with so many different audience, you know, and to make them aware that cleanliness of the beach is very important, especially for our marine turtles and whale species. It's very important.
So how can the international community support your work?
Well, the way they can support mainly, like I always say, I tell them that in Africa, we have a lot of drive and passion, and we have a lot of energy. But what we don't have, what we lack to an extent is funding support, you know, getting access to some of these grants, you know, and the opportunities that can help to push our work forward. Like some of these organizations, like the World Wildlife Fund, some of them have funding, but sometimes when you look on their site, Nigeria is not eligible to apply, which makes things really, you're not too excited, you know, because we want to do some of this wild science too, but sometimes you're not on the eligible list of countries to apply. So I think what they can do is to help for scientists, conservationists in Nigeria to access grants. If they're able to access grants, a lot of work will go on. Some researchers don't even know how to write a grant, you know, an award-winning grant. You know, some conservationists, you know, they just go to the field and all that. They don't know how to assess the grants they need for their work. Like someone was discussing with me today that he saw a World Wildlife Fund collaboration opportunities. How do we go about it that we need to see and all that? So those are the key things I think we need. Funding to have good information, you know, like having libraries on the ocean, maybe an ocean library, you know. And then we also don't have very excellent laboratory facilities and ocean spaces. Like Nigeria, for one, should have a National Maritime Museum or something, but we don't have anything like that, you know.
Oh, wow.
We do not have...
Or a research facility.
Yeah, we don't have an aqua, you know, like an aquamaria that you see in developed countries where people can come and really, you know, simulate the ocean. So these are things that we need to do, and we need to find, you know, funding to be able to do some of these things. So I think that's one of the key things. It's not the only important thing, but it's one of the major things. Like last year, I got a grant with the Ocean Conservancy, a small grant, and I was able to go to the...
Congratulations. Course,
yes, I wanted to educate the coastal communities on converting plastics to reusable items for a while. But I did not have funding. But when we got that fund, we were able to do 4 trainings for coastal community on how to convert plastic debris, like bottles, caps, and all that, how to convert it into reusable items that they can even sell. And some of the women have actually adopted, you know, that project. They now make those stools from plastics and foam, and they sell it in their community, you know. So those are the things. So we need that support, you know, from the international community. I know there's been a lot of support, but as far as I know, for my generation, I think we need a lot of support to be able to do, you know, excellent research.
Yes. Yes, well, for sure we have to find a way to bring that support to Nigeria, because it sounds as though there are a lot of things that can be done. We just need to find the support, find the funding. What message, Ronki, would you have for a young woman or a young man who might want to follow a similar trajectory as you and do similar work as you? What message would you have for them?
Yeah, the message I'll have for such a person is be brave. Don't ever get discouraged. Go for the stars. You will always get there, no matter how slow it is. It has been a very long and slow journey, because sometimes I have the opportunities, but I don't have the understanding. Sometimes I have the understanding, but the funding doesn't show up then. When I went for that first conference, I actually met someone that was like, oh, he wants to come to Nigeria to see sea turtles. But I didn't know anything about sea turtles then. And so it happens like that. That's life. And then sometimes I have the knowledge and all that, but the funding is not forthcoming. So things do not always come in one day, especially when it's a new area. You just have to be patient. You just have to wait for the right time, you know. And there are times that I've been bored and I'm like, oh, I can't keep, you know, spending money, recipients to talk to. Nobody is supporting me. Nobody is giving me money. And I got really fed up. But you just have to keep forging ahead, because when you least expect it, you know, things would happen. So I would like to encourage every young man and woman there to be brave. Keep at it. Don't give up. Don't give up. You will surely get there.
I love that. Amazing. So now just last couple of questions and then we're finished. Now for some fun. So as you know, the podcast features different women around the world who we believe are embodying the spirit of a mermaid, where you're intelligent, you're fierce, you adore the ocean, and you also happen to work in ocean conservation and marine science. What's your interpretation of a mermaid? I'm just curious.
Oh my God. Well, there are two interpretations, you know. Initially, when you said, oh, when I was invited to this program, I said that I would not like to be referred to as a mermaid, because it connotes, like in Africa, it connotes like a deity, you know, like a goddess.
Yes.
You know, that's what a mermaid is, you know, a deity. And in Yoruba, they call them, in my language, Yoruba language, they call them Yemoja. That means like the goddess of the ocean. She has a tail instead of a leg. You understand? And then the body is half human, half fish. And I remembered when I was younger, I used to read a lot of stories about the underwater. There was this fiction about the underwater life and the mermaid capturing a man, enslaving him and all those things. So it was very scary. You know, those are the kind of stories when you read them in the night, you can't sleep, you know? So my original connotation of the mermaid, you know, is just that way, you know, as in, oh, mermaid, And then there are some good mermaids too that in some stories portrayed as a goddess that maybe someone went to ask for a child, you know, and then the water mermaid gave her a child and all that. So there are so many different sides to it, but generally, when you say mermaid, people think, oh, Yemoja, the goddess, you know, the goddess of the ocean and all that, that can do good and can also punish you for evils. So that's the general connotation. But also, mermaid could also connote, you know, somebody that is passionate about the ocean, that is good at what they do for the ocean, that cares for the ocean and all that. So that's my the two sides of, you know, being a mermaid.
That's wonderful. Definitely. And I like the way that the story behind in the US and the Caribbean, we say Yemanya, right? It's the same. It's like a translation of Yoruba folklore, right? There's just that crossover. I mean, it happened through generations, but I've always loved the idea of her as a deity because she has that duality. And I think that also reflects the duality of the ocean. The ocean has the power to create and also to destroy. It always has. And that's just, you know, the way that the ocean works, and it deserves respect.
Exactly. Exactly. Respect your seas and ocean.
Yes, yes. And that's what we're hoping to create through this podcast and inspire more people to show respect and love for the ocean wherever they live on this planet. So that is our goal. Well, Ronki, thank you so much for this wonderful interview. I'm just honored and just so grateful that I got a chance to talk to you and meet you virtually. But is there anything else that you wanted to add or that we didn't cover that maybe you wanted to speak about?
Well, the other thing I'd like to speak about is speak out to researchers and women not to be intimidated in the marine science, because we have the issue of gender bias in the marine science. And at my institute, when I joined, you know, the men, they always go offshore more than the women, you know. So they go offshore because they think, oh, women, you should stay at home and, you know, take care of the children and all that. But I insisted I was going to go for a particular project because I'm also a marine mammal observer. So I was trained for that as a result of not allowing myself to be intimidated as a woman, because I indicated interest. And my boss was like, are you sure you can go for this thing? And all that. I said, yes, why not? So I was.
And what happens as a marine mammal observer? Are you going out on a vessel?
To record sightings of whales and dolphins. And in my experience going offshore, you know, I've only met one other woman offshore. It's a space that a lot of women are not able to go into in Nigeria. But I think the narrative should change, because what a man can do, a woman can also do better. So that women should be more involved in offshore work, because that would help us to have a gender balance in that area too.
Completely agree. Wow. Well, that's wonderful, Rocky. Thank you so much. I want to let you get some beauty sleep.
Yeah.
So late over there. But again, thank you. Thank you for doing this at this hour. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure to be on the program as well. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
21st Century Mermaids is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Sole Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. This podcast is supported by the Baum Foundation. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.